Hello and welcome to Taking Care of Business. I'm Jackie Mitchell. Today's show is not focusing on success. It's focusing on how to fix things, how to fix dysfunctional teams, how to recover from failures, how to rebuild business relationships, stop destructive behaviours, and how to avoid some simple problems within your team and also within your business that you may not be aware of. So it's a real fix-it show today. We're going to give you some wonderful tips. Now, our first guest is almost Mr. Fix-It. He helps people run their business better. He has written a book aptly named Run Your Business Better, and he works extensively with business owners who are in pain. Stephen Barnes, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jackie. Nice to be back.
Great to be to have you here. And it was wonderful that you sent me a message updating me on new laws for entrepreneurs and businesses that could affect them, particularly those that are struggling. So thank you so much for alerting me to that and helping our listeners always continually improve. Now, just in a nutshell, what are some of these changes that are happening?
Well, it all stems from the federal government's drive to help businesses succeed. So they've changed some laws to make it more favourable for businesses to keep going even if they're struggling. So some of those are Safe Harbour that came in July last year. There's a change to the Bankruptcy Act coming in probably next year. You probably see in the papers and news a lot of talk about Phoenix activities. There was also some changes around credit reporting by the ATO. And then there's another thing called ipso facto laws, which is a little bit technical being Latin, but that also impacts business owners as well.
Yeah, look, I think that's a really nice little segue to remind our listeners that some of these laws are quite complicated and complex, and to always seek professional advice and to seek an expert opinion. So let's sort of strip that back or unpack these a little bit, Stephen, to something a little bit more tangible, I suppose, for our listeners to understand. It sounds fantastic. Is it as good as it sounds?
It's probably not as good as it sounds, and I think that's a big worry, is because they're making a big noise about it, but it doesn't actually apply to all businesses. So a lot of these laws actually only apply to businesses that are incorporated as companies, not as sole traders, for instance. So Safe Harbour is one of those. Phoenix Activities is another one that would apply to.
Okay, so let's start from the beginning. I suppose we have to look at, from a business perspective, what your business structure is, whether you're a company, whether you're a sole trader, in a partnership, and what's quite common now is more and more businesses are now running under a trust for lots of different reasons. So it's always good to speak to your accountant about which is the best structure for you. So majority of entrepreneurs or small business, Stephen, in your experience, what structure do they tend to favour?
I think they mainly start out as sole traders, and then as they grow, they morph into a company.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, as a rule.
Yeah.
And they do so because there's a lot of protections and benefits for being an incorporated company.
Yeah, well, one is the company tax rate's lower, isn't it? And it does protect you a little bit from that. So, okay, so let's talk about changes. If your business is a company, let's talk about some key changes. So what would they be?
Well, one of them was the Safe Harbour rules that came in July 2017. So it's been going for just over a year. What that meant is that it stopped company directors getting too concerned about insolvent trading, and it's given them a avenue where they can continue trading even while they may technically be insolvent. But of course, you know, nothing's a free lunch, and there's some strings attached to that as well, so that people need to be aware of. So, and again, this is where a lot of the smaller companies, so companies say with a turnover of under a couple of million dollars, it may sound great to them, but it may not necessarily be applicable to them. So They've got to be aware of some of the thresholds and reliance on those things as well.
Right, and I was interested in the Bankruptcy Act, and it's always that sort of evil word that we don't like to talk about from a business perspective, but I was really pleased to see that only 19% of insolvencies are business-related. That was lower than I thought it would be.
Yeah, so most of them are things to do with your own personal credit, so rather than a business going or being the cause for them going insolvent. And one of the changes that's being proposed at the moment is that insolvency will bankruptcy only lasts for a year rather than 3 years, which it is currently. And what I expect we'll see with that is a lot of businesses not entering into debt arrangements when they do go bankrupt, when the owners go bankrupt. So I think that's a concern for creditors. So I think creditors, so if you're a supplier to, or you bought something from a business and they go into bankruptcy, then I think that's a concern for you, and that can have a flow-on effect to your own business as well.
Yeah, let's just talk about that for a minute, because, look, it certainly doesn't encourage people to avoid bankruptcy, doesn't it? It's almost, I don't know if I like it, Stephen. What's your view?
To me, it almost encourages people to go bankrupt. Mm. And they're also removing some other restrictions which were a disincentive for people to go bankrupt, so, such as the restriction for applying for credit while disclosing that your bankrupt status. You'll be able to apply for credit going forward. You'll be able to travel overseas without seeking permission from your trustee. You'll be able to obtain certain licences and memberships. So, for instance, if you're an accountant and you want to be a member of the Chartered Accountants, you don't have to disclose now, or you won't have to disclose that you're a bankrupt when you put your application in.
Yeah, I mean, our case for not liking it is building, certainly it's removing barriers and things like stigma and things. And so why are they doing it? What's their motivation for doing this?
The motivation is to get people back up and going and having another go. So it's all about the, to succeed, you have to fail sort of mentality.
Right.
So, and that's driving a lot of this reform at the moment. They understand that a large number of startup businesses fail, but it's a numbers game. So if you start up 10 times, then you're likely to succeed by the 10th time sort of scenario.
Right, okay. Okay, well, it's an interesting way of thinking. Now, what about credit reporting to the ATO? Has that changed?
It changed just over a year ago as well, and I think this is a little unknown factor by most small businesses, is that if you have an outstanding debt with ATO of more than 90 days and over $10,000, and you haven't made a substantial sort of effort to raise that matter with the ATO, so you just put your head in the sand, the ATO can actually put that debt on your credit file, which will last for 5 years.
Wow. Okay. So maybe that's counteracting the Bankruptcy Act. Some counterbalancing going on there, using an accounting term.
Yeah. Which makes obviously it hard for you to borrow money to keep going, or to get supply agreements so that you can keep going. So it's a really big tool that the ATO have. It's stopping businesses just carrying on incurring debts.
Interesting. Now let's talk about some ways we can avoid some of these problems. And as I said earlier, anyone listening now, please seek professional advice on these new laws that are affecting businesses and entrepreneurs, particularly those that are struggling. But please seek expert advice, but let's talk about some simple ways to avoid the problem, Stephen. So with the ATO, I suppose one is to engage with them early, not put your head in the sand, I'd imagine.
Absolutely. That's the best thing you can do, is if you have a problem, if you can't, or you're going to have a problem with your lodgement or a payment, get hold of the ATO. Get it on file, get it so that you've got a payment plan. that'll be the first thing that you need to do with the ATO.
Okay, that's good advice. And the next thing is about your BAS statements. Now, most small business and entrepreneurs still do their own BAS statement and making sure that you do it on time.
Yeah, it doesn't sound that hard, but it's something that a lot of businesses, and especially businesses that are struggling, their accounting systems and their focus on doing accounting is often a little bit lax. So I'd encourage you to keep those up to date. And I think the real thing that the main message with all of these legislations is to put your hand up early and go and get someone to help you.
Yeah, look, and I also think not only from a technical perspective, but from a psychological perspective as well, because it has enormous effect, and putting your head in the sand and pretending it's not there is not an effective strategy, let's face it. So have a talk to someone that you know that you're comfortable with or a professional about it, because it will affect every area of your life. It'll be causing you more stress. It'll be affecting your sleep at night. There's lots of issues there, Stephen, isn't there? Now, what are some of the sort of other key issues in your experience that you find entrepreneurs particularly face?
Well, I think businesses and struggling businesses are a bit like treating an addict, really, Jackie. So, you know, they've got to accept that they've got a problem, and when they do that, then they can be helped. And I think another part of that which goes with that is that you may be a great practitioner, but doesn't mean you know how to run a business well. And I had a lady in Sydney ring me this morning. She's a home care provider, for instance, been a nurse for 15 years, got a good little home care business, but she admitted, I don't know how to run a business.
And
I said to her at the time, that's the first thing you need to do, is admit that you don't know how to run your business.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole another discussion. I meet lots of people who start a business, and I say, have you got a business plan? First question, they go, no. And I go, oh, straight away, red flag. And they're not doing it because they're trying to cut corners. They're just completely ignorant as to what is involved. And I think that's a real concern, particularly when there's a real growth and rise on people with people starting their own businesses now. So hopefully they're listening to podcasts and radio shows like this to help them improve. Now, Stephen, have you got a new book in you?
Oh, I haven't got a new book at the moment, Jackie. No, I haven't. But I'm starting gathering some bits and pieces, so watch this space and think about putting another one out later.
Great. So your book at the moment is Run Your Business Better, and you'll find that anywhere you can buy books, I'm assuming.
Yeah, particularly online. It is in major bookshops in Australia at the moment. I think it's in Melbourne and Sydney airports as well. You can buy it from my publisher, Major Street Publishing, or myself. You can buy it, I think, on some online portals like Booktopia and Book Depository, for instance, and Amazon. Yeah.
Well, if anyone wants to find out more about Stephen Barnes, your website, Stephen, is?
www.byronvaleadvisors.com.
Byron Vale Advisors. Stephen Barnes, great book, Run Your Business Better, for anyone starting business. Also a great gift for someone close to you who is starting a business, as it gives you a practical guide as to what you should or shouldn't do. Stephen Barnes, always good talking to you. Thank you so much for your precious time.
Thanks, Jackie. Very much appreciated.
Great. You're listening to Taking Care of Business as we speak to the best brains in the business world. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Taking Care of Business. Today we focus on fixing issues. That was amazing. It was George Michael. We all love that song. We're looking at fixing issues within businesses, and a crucial area are the behaviour of leaders. Modern leaders face a rapidly changing environment where traditional ways of leading teams and building organisations are no longer as effective as they once were. So I thought it was time that I actually had a chat to a leadership specialist. I'd love to welcome Corinne Armour to the show. Hello.
Thank you, Jackie.
Great to have you here, Corinne. Now, you've just released a new book called Leaders Who Ask. Why is telling less and asking more effective? You talk about building fearless cultures by telling less and asking more. Why is that so effective?
Well, when you tell people what to do, it tends to disempower and disengage. So if I tell you what to do, you might listen, but it's only your rational brain that's going to be listening. Whereas if I can ask you a question that leads to insight, and insight is that flash of inspiration where you bring together perhaps even seemingly unrelated things to form a new idea. If I ask you a question that leads to insight that you've developed for yourself, then there's an emotional component to that. So you're much more likely to remember it. There's a connection to the hippocampus, the part of the brain that is responsible for long-term memory. You're also more likely to be able to extrapolate that insight to other contexts. So I tell you what to do, you might know what to do right now. You may or may not listen. I mean, you may or may not remember, and you won't have that real connection to it. Whereas if I ask you, you come up with your own insight, you're likely to remember it, you're likely to feel an ownership of it, and you're more able to extrapolate that to apply it to similar situations in the future. So it's a win-win.
I love your link to the emotional links in the brain, and those that listen regularly know that I'm a neuro nut. I love the latest findings, and it's the findings are happening so much quickly. It's unbelievable. It's actually a real game changer in my view. And if we can understand how our brain works, we can understand how our customers' brains work, and that helps us effectively communicate, effectively market, so many things that we could do. And this is one element that I loved in your book, was really focusing on the emotional links. It's quite often an area that is overlooked in businesses. Has that been your experience?
I think so too. We're very good at rational. We're very good at telling. We're very good at quantitative, you know, basis for why we should do things. And people don't buy on logic. They buy on emotion and then they justify on logic. So I think the more we can tap into what's real for people, what's important for people, then the more we're going to engage them and the more we're going to build accountability.
Yeah, there was a guest I had on a few weeks ago now, Yvette Cordy. I don't know if you know Yvette, but she's just written a book called Cultivating Curiosity. And probably out of the whole book, the one point that really resonated with me was she said, don't be an expert, be a novice, because a novice will ask so many more questions. And it's a similar point to what you're making, is asking questions. And I know with this radio show that I've been doing now for six and coming up to 7 years, and I've interviewed over 1,000 experts, and I'm a bit nerdy and I keep sort of notes on key points, and I thought I'll go back and have a look at the top three most common themes or most common bits of advice that these incredible brains like yourself are sharing and see if there's a common thread, because if all these successful people are saying it, what would that be? And number one was just ask. And that's exactly what you're doing, what you're saying in your book. So there you go. You're another one on my list of experts or novices saying the importance of asking. Why don't leaders ask more?
Yeah.
Why don't they?
Well, part of it is the way we have grown up perceiving leaders as being those with the answers. And it wasn't that long ago that we really did expect our leaders to know everything. But we're in an environment now that's so complex and changing so rapidly that it's just not possible for one person to know everything. And so I think intellectually we know that, but we still feel the requirement at almost an unconscious level to have the answers. So I had a conversation with a client once who was really good at coaching in a performance conversation. So when he knew he was sitting down having a performance conversation with somebody, he was really good at coaching, but on the job, when people would fire questions at him, he would just answer them. And he knew that that wasn't helping him to get things done and to become more strategic, because it was keeping him constantly with the need to provide the answers. And so I said to him, why do you provide the answers? And he said, it's a habit, and it's about helping too hard. So And time, and the third one is time. So, you know, I'm habitually I answer, and so you ask me a question without even thinking, I'll fire off the answer. Time, I think it's faster to give you the answer, and in that moment it might be, but if I'm maintaining a dependency on me, then that's not faster in the long term. It's not even faster in the medium term. And then that, in his case, helping, and what he realised is he was helping too hard, that his helping was actually disempowering people around him.
Oh, that's really, really fascinating. In your book, you talk about engagement is down globally. What did you mean by that?
Sorry, I've just lost you there. Engagement is down globally.
So obviously we're disengaging more.
We are disengaging more, although interestingly, figures that have come out even since the book was published, when you talk about neuroscience shifting fast, it does actually look like engagement is going up slightly. But even if it is, so some latest figures that I looked at, global engagement is 65%. So that's people who are saying that I am somewhat or super very engaged. But that means that 2 out of 5 people you're working with would rather be somewhere else doing something else with someone else.
Mm.
And Australian engagement figures are 60%, so lower than that global engagement figure, you know, despite the fact that we're the lucky country. So regardless of what it is in your company, I think anybody who's disengaged, then they're not making the contribution that you want them to make.
Mm. Yeah, it was interesting also in your book, and it got me thinking. You said building fearless cultures by telling less and asking more, but then I got stuck on the word fearless, and I thought to myself, as I do,
provocative, isn't it?
It is. It's a very provocative word, and I thought to myself, do all leaders need to be fearless? Do they?
Well, I think yes, but can I define fearless?
Please.
So for me, it's not about being completely fearless. It's about fearing less. Because the only time you're going to have a complete absence of fear is when you're drunk or dead. And neither are particularly useful for leadership. So it's about recognising where there's a fear and using that as data. So do all leaders need to be fearless? If that's what fearless means, then yes. I think it takes a level of courage to connect with your own stuff. Now, it takes a level of courage and of bravery to connect deeply and to engage with other people. So that's even without thinking about what are some of the big decisions that you're going to have to make, that you're going to just need to defend to your stakeholders, to your team, to the media, to your customers, depending on what role you're in. So I think, yes, we all need an element of fearlessness.
That's a wonderful answer. Thank you for that. Now, I do have to ask you, as in prep for today, and I wanted to sort of find out a bit more about you, and I was completely fascinated by and slightly distracted by you living and working in a jungle refugee camp on the edge of a war zone. Can you please tell us more about that?
Well, and maybe arguably that's where an element of the fearlessness came from. So, yes, I lived for nearly 3 years in a jungle refugee camp on the Thai-Burmese border. So I was working with Karen refugees from Thailand on the edge of a war zone. I grew up in country Victoria, very comfortable, privileged farming background, never expected to find myself living in a war zone. It's probably true that my mother never expected to have an elder daughter living in a war zone either. That experience did a lot for me in terms of defining leadership and just watching the people who I was working directly with, the local people, watching real leaders in action there. And also thinking about when you've got hundreds of thousands of people in refugee camps, that's such a complete waste of human potential. And that's a problem of leadership. And I came back to Australia and I thought, well, you know, I'm back here and everyone has the opportunity in Australia to live to their full potential. You know, we don't have these challenges. And we don't have challenges quite on that wide-scale level. But every company I go into, I meet people who aren't living up to their potential. I meet teams that aren't living up to their potential. And so that's that same fearlessness again, that we all need that. I could talk about living in a jungle refugee camp for hours and hours.
Well, we might need to take that on notice and have you back again. But I do love the phrase, and you referred to that, the human potential, and you said that's where you have an active passion to help others avoid the wasted human potential that results when leadership is missing. That is a really, really powerful statement, and hopefully you've got that as one of your quotes, because that was mind-blowing. So well done with that. Now let's just quickly talk about this book, Leaders Who Ask, Corinne Armour, and it's available everywhere you can find a book. It's a nice picture of you on the back, and I highly recommend it for those. And how have you been finding the process? Is this your first book?
No, this is my third book. So two mainstream leadership books, actually four, depending on how you count them, and then two specialist texts in people development. This is my first solo one, though, I have to say, and it is different writing on your own than writing with two others.
Yeah,
absolutely. And so it's very exciting now that it's done and out, and it's getting a really good response, which is reassuring, because you spend a lot of time in your own head when you write. And even when you write, when you're writing, as I do, things that you're doing every day, so it also reflects the experience of my clients in the book, but it's still a lot of time in your head. And so it's nice to actually get it out in the world and have people respond positively to it.
Yeah, well, congratulations. It's an enormous effort, and even more impressive that it's your third book, but the first one that you've written on your own, and I've got a very strong feeling there's going to be more to come. Your next book, Corinne, what is it?
Oh, I'm not thinking, but I'm not completely clear yet, but I think the working title is Fearless Challenge, something about how to have the conversations in the workplace that need to happen.
Okay, it's exciting. Okay, well, stay tuned. Look forward to it. Corinne Armour, thank you so much for your valuable time. And if anyone listening wants to find out more about you, where's the best place for them to go?
They can go to www.corinnearmour.com.
Excellent. Easy. Wonderful. Thanks again.
Thanks, Jackie.
Bye. You're listening to Taking Care of Business as we are talking to some amazing business brains, and we look forward to your company on the other side of this break. Welcome back to Taking Care of Business as we are talking today about how to fix it in your business. If you're working in or advising or managing a dysfunctional team, then you know firsthand the destructive impacts of conflict, bad behaviour and poor culture has. Our next guest is going to guide and help us to relieve the headaches for managers and business owners in managing teams. She's the co-founder and managing director of workplace advisory firm WorkLogic and published author Rose Bryant-Smith. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jackie.
Great to have you here. Now, Rose, I've got it. Start really obvious question, and it was something when I was looking at your book, which we'll talk about in a sec, but what are the characteristics of a dysfunctional team? Because I looked at that and thought, I wonder if my team's dysfunctional. So what should I be looking for?
Well, most of the signs of dysfunctional teams are pretty obvious. So I think if you don't feel like you're working in a dysfunctional team, you're probably not. But I think one of the things to look for if you fear that perhaps your team isn't working at its best is a conflict that's not being addressed, things that are ticking on over time and that nobody feels safe enough or brave enough to have a conversation about. Individuals who are behaving badly, like lots of gossip in the tea room, type of dragging down conversations, and also sometimes what might be put forward as all good fun, in fact, is quite toxic and nasty. So jokes about particular groups of people, or undermining and excluding individuals.
It's interesting you mentioned jokes, because I've always had a view that, I mean, humour is a wonderful gift, but it can be used for evil, and a lot of people use jokes and humour to be really nasty, but they sort of hide it or cover it up by saying, I'm just joking, and not realising that the damage that they're doing.
Yeah, that's right. And I think another another thing that people do is forget that when you're at work, even if you're mates with some of your colleagues, the different rules apply. So sometimes people think, oh, well, if it's okay down at the pub to make some joke about a racist group, and when I say okay, not by me, but by some people, then that should be fine at work and it's all a bit of fun. The reality is that in a workplace, we're all subject to not only the policies and procedures that apply in that workplace to how we treat each other, but also the state and federal laws which ban discrimination, bullying and other nasty conduct. So we at WorkLogic, we do a lot of investigations of allegations of misconduct like racism and bullying, and people do sadly often try and argue, oh, it was just a joke, and the person who's taken offence just doesn't have a sense of humour and needs to lighten up, but that's almost never the case. The fact is, if you're saying something that's racist and you think it's funny, doesn't mean it's not racist.
Is that a growing trend that you've seen, that more and more people are taking workplaces to task over this behaviour?
I think people these days are more prepared to put their hand up and say, hang on, that's not on, when they see something going on in the workplace that's offensive to them. And I think that's a really good thing. I think that with, firstly, the legal protections around proper behaviour in the workplace, you know, banning things like bullying, sexual harassment, and other inappropriate conduct. But also, I think as a society, we've got a better recognition that no one should have to show up at work and be subjected to nasty behaviour that causes distress and even mental illness. And I think some of the trends we've seen over the last 12 months, like the Me Too movement that originated in the US, have really indicated that it's not only is it okay to speak up when toxic or inappropriate behaviour is happening in the workplace, but in fact it's our duty to our colleagues and really to the community to say, hang on a sec, it's not okay to me even if somebody else is being treated badly. Because this isn't just an ethical question and not just a legal question. In addition, it's really damaging to the business as well as to individual people's health and safety.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It's interesting because it sort of got me thinking, and I've listened to people say, oh, you know, we're being overly politically correct, and I've gone, well, I don't know if is that true or is it not? Are people becoming more sensitive, or is it only because awareness has increased? What's your view?
Yeah, I don't think people are becoming more sensitive. I just think that this whole idea of, oh, it's all just political correctness gone mad, is often a backlash against a change in values in the workplace and an attempt to go back to these inverted commas good old days of the 1960s. But the reality is that these days, that sort of nasty behaviour like hazing rituals or people being required to tolerate nasty drinking culture or sexual harassment, that's been quite appropriately left behind. And the fact is that sort of conduct, well, firstly in my view, it was never okay, but these days it's recognised that sort of behaviour really does damage not only the individual job satisfaction, psychological health, and that things like sleepless nights and anxiety are quite common for people who are harassed and bullied. But in addition, that one person who's behaving badly in the workplace actually has quite a damaging ripple effect on the broader team in terms of starting to poison the culture. And if the workplace doesn't act on that bad behaviour, sort of setting a trend that it's okay if we treat each other this way. And in addition, it damages productivity. It diverts management attention, and it's more likely that the best performer in a team will leave if somebody else in the team is behaving badly and being allowed to get away with it. So there was a really interesting study done that was published in a Harvard Business School report a couple of years ago, which found that keeping a toxic employee on the payroll costs the average business about $15,000 American dollars per year more because of the damage to productivity and the greater likelihood that the stars of the team are going to leave. So, you know, so this isn't just a nice to have. This is something that employers really need to sit up and pay attention to. If they're carrying a toxic team, they need to really think about what is the cost to the business, as well as the additional legal and compliance risk that we're bearing, and to think about, you know, if we could save an extra $15,000 a year and improve productivity, you know, get the team back on track as far as its focus on the work, wouldn't that be a good thing?
Yeah, well, I find it quite fascinating. I was thinking about it in prep for our conversation today, and I thought it's almost impossible to avoid, because you're dealing with human beings and behaviour is always going to vary, and it's more about how to manage it in the workplace, because there's always going to be certain personality types that people are not going to get on. There's going to be the politics and things. So it's more about managing it. And so in your new book, it's a nice little segue to talk about your new book, Fix Your Team, The Tools You Need to Rebuild Relationships, Address Conflict and Stop Destructive Behaviour. So I thought we might just focus the next little while on what some of the tools are. So let's sort of focus more on what we can do to help manage it. So let's start with rebuilding relationships. What are some of the advice that or guidance that you would give someone?
So for the manager to help the team rebuild relationships?
Yes. Yeah.
So I think if you're in a managerial position, you've got to be aware that it's legitimate for you to intervene if people in the team are disagreeing and that disagreement is actually impacting on the ability to do work. So I think a lot of managers are hesitant to call out, say, gossiping or undermining behaviour because they don't want to create more conflict. I think sometimes there's the fear, or they don't want to be seen as coming in heavy or someone who's, you know, not up for a bit of fun. They want to get along with a lot of people. And in addition, I think a lot of managers, in fact, you know, like everybody else, fear conflict or are not quite sure how to step in. But I think the first step is for the manager to really look at what's going on in the team and think, are these dysfunctional relationships and the way people are treating each other damaging our ability to do the best work we can do as a group? And if they are, then that is a legitimate and, in fact, an appropriate thing for you to intervene in. And there's a few different ways you can do that. You could have some offline conversations with a couple of individuals and check with them to see whether what you're perceiving to be problem relationships, in fact, is what's happening. You can develop some self-reflection in the whole team, doing some sort of a team building or review exercise where the team thinks about, well, what are we trying to achieve together? Are we clear on that? Are we clear how each one of us and our work fits into that broader effort? And also, do we agree on the values that should guide how we get there? Because quite often, there's a lack of clarity in the way the team is operating that's meaning that individual spats or bad behaviour by one person are being allowed to continue over a long period of time because there just isn't sufficient accountability for what we're doing and how we treat each other. So I think the first thing for managers is really to decide to take action and then to think carefully about how they can do that.
That's wonderful advice, Rose Bryant-Smith. Your book is available, I'm assuming, where all books, good books, are sold?
It is, and online also with Book Depository and Booktopia.
Excellent. Now, if people want to find more about Work Logic and more about you, where's the best place for them to find out?
Yeah, so they can find out on worklogicinoneword.com.au, which is the website of our consulting firm. And we've also set up a separate site, fix-your-team.com, which talks about the book. There's a blog with articles that we've written and published in newspapers and magazines about various team dysfunctions. And also there's some downloadable training for managers, 40 minutes of training about the 5 key skills that managers can develop to help turn around their team and bring out the best in everyone.
Oh, that's great, Rose. Thank you so much for your wisdom today and sharing all that knowledge. Really appreciate your valuable time.
Thanks for having me, Jackie.
Thank you. Great to talk to you. You're listening to Taking Care of Business as we are picking the best brains in the business world as we're talking about fixing it today. And we'll be right back after this short break. That's the end of another stimulating show. We hope you've enjoyed eavesdropping on our conversation, picked up some tips, learned something new, or at the very least feel inspired. If you just joined us, you missed a lot. The podcast will be on the website, rwpfm.com.au, and you can connect with me to continue the conversation, Jackie Mitchell, on social media or at brandstorm.com.au. Thank you today to our worldly and thought-provoking guests. We look forward to your company next Friday at 11 a.m. In the meantime, keep taking care of your business.